Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Journalist Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. He's also the winner of the 2008 National Magazine Award for Columns and Commentary. Matt's latest project is a serial online book called Hate Incorporated: Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. Matt joins us now. Matt, I was wondering, what impact did reading Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's 1988 book, Manufacturing Consent, have on you?
It had a huge impact on me because I had grown up in a family of journalists, and I had never thought that there was a propaganda aspect to American journalism. That book was a real eye-opener for me, and it became a guide in my own career. It really describes how propaganda works in America. Obviously, we don't have a system of political commissars who come in and delete your copy, but we do have a lot of internal pressures and unseen propaganda ideas that artificially narrow the conversation, and that's what that book was about.
You've described your new serialized book, Hate Inc., as a rethink of manufacturing consent. Why do you think it needs rethinking?
Well, because that book came out in 1988, just before a whole bunch of really revolutionary things happened to the commercial media system in America. There was the advent of the 24-hour news cycle. The internet was on the way. And then there was a significant business change that was really innovated by networks like Fox News, which was really about segmenting the news audience into different demographics and capturing them, you know, as opposed to going for the widest possible audience. So Chomsky and Herman were really writing about a very different time in American media. And I thought that in this new landscape that's very fragmented and atomized, it would be worth looking to see how their propaganda model held up over time.
So is there one recurring theme that runs through Hate Inc.?
Yes. I think the main theme that runs through the book is that we in the commercial media now are financially incentivized to wind people up and make them angry with each other. Whereas in the old days of media, back in the days when we had three networks and just a couple of newspaper chains, we had exactly the opposite dynamic in media. The idea was to make the audiences less wound up and actually more placid because we were trying to reach the widest possible audience. Now what we do is we have a divided demographic where, you know, MSNBC goes after liberals, Fox goes after conservatives, and the easiest financial route to success is just making those groups angry with each other.
Your father, Mike Taibbi, was an NBC television reporter, and you talk about one of the nightly rituals that you saw him doing when you were a boy. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, my father had this thing called the phone attack. Yeah. I was fascinated by my father's work when I was a kid. He was a television reporter. My childhood was a lot like the movie Anchorman. He used to come home at night, and he would take his Rolodex. That was back when people had Rolodexes. It's a card file for those of you in the digital age that has phone numbers in it. And he would randomly call sources, whether he had something to talk about with them or not, and just sort of keep in touch with people. And this basically taught me that reporting is a job about maintaining relationships, whether or not you actually have to have anything to talk about with sources. And he would do that for hours and hours every night. He would sit there with a highball and a Camel unfiltered cigarette and just make sure that those sources were fresh.
And as you say in the book, it's also important to ask people to talk about whatever they want to talk about, not just one thing in particular.
Right, and this is something that's really been lost in the modern age of reporting, where what happens more often than not now is people sit down and do stories and they look for links to support a thesis that they already have. Whereas the old school of reporting is you just sort of talk to people all the time and you ask them open-ended questions and they tell you, they offer you what they know about things. And so you're not looking for a predetermined thesis. You're not trying to get quotes to fill in a blank that you've already laid out on paper.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference. The idea of physically talking to people, making it an open-ended conversation, as opposed to what we do now.
Well, what else did you learn about journalism from your dad?
I think, you know, the main thing I learned about work from my father was that reporting is primarily about talking to people. My father is sort of a master at walking into any room and getting people to talk on camera within a couple of minutes. He's a very sort of engaging, jovial person. He was sort of born for the business in a way that I really wasn't. And the way that he does the job is a lot like the way a lot of people back, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s did it. They were sort of inherently iconoclastic. They did not view themselves as part of the power structure. They were always challenging the things that any politician said, whether they were on one party or the other. My father always had that very deep independent streak. He sort of liked to tell other people's stories.
As you point out in Hate, Inc., journalists are now creating content for specific demographics. So how does this focus on demographics shape the journalism you write for Rolling Stone?
Well, it's difficult because I try to fight against that instinct, actually. One of the things that struck me when I came home, I lived overseas for 12 years.
Yeah.
And when I came back to the United States after being in the former Soviet Union, I went to a bookstore and I saw that there were two shelves. There were shelves for Republicans and shelves for Democrats. And you could tell which kind of book was for whom from 10 feet off because they had different kinds of designs. And I thought to myself, that's so weird. Like, what writer automatically wants to turn off half the audience before you even get close to the book? And so as a writer, I want everybody to read what I write. I don't want to limit it to one demographic. I want everybody to be interested in it and potentially to get into the story. I often challenge and disappoint my audience, I think, and that's you know, been a bit of a problem in my career sometimes.
You've used sports analogies to describe presidential campaigns. You've said that the preseason is the straw polls, the regular season is the primaries, and the playoffs are the general election. So it only makes sense that you argue that the media industrial complex has turned the news into sports. Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. One of the things is that sports is a format that definitely works commercially, that the networks are familiar with. They know how to sell it. They know how to market it. And we've stolen a lot of things from how we cover sports and transplanted it onto presidential campaigning. You see that a lot, especially on election nights. If you watch election coverage on the cable networks, you'll see that the setup on the sets is almost exactly like a Sunday countdown show for the NFL.
Yeah.
You'll have one analyst from one team, one analyst from another team, and then there are people who make predictions about which team is going to win, and everything becomes about the horse race. We borrow a lot of the language and the stylistic aspects of sports coverage for things like debates, which are just chock full of boxing metaphors from start to finish.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is just a formula because it's easier to train audiences to understand politics as something that they have to root for, as opposed to trying to train them to think in a nuanced way about a very, very difficult subject.
Yeah. You also compare reading the news to smoking. How so?
This kind of content that we're doing nowadays, which is basically about monetizing anger. If you click on basically any news story through social media, it's geared up to make you upset about something. And Donald Trump is a perfect example of a political story that people just can't have any neutral feelings about. They either love the guy and hate his enemies, or they hate him. And so any story about basically anything involving Trump is going to get people furious. Then they're going to read that. They're going to go to social media. They're going to argue with people about that. And they're going to stay in this emotionally amplified, heightened state of sort of anxiety all day long. And that has an addictive effect. This has been talked about by people who study sort of the way that social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter work, that people become addicted to the dopamine rush of anger that they get from reading a news story. And we just sort of sociopathically crank this stuff out there and dump it on audiences without thinking about what it does to their mental health. But I think most people would agree that if they stop following the news for any length of time, and you notice this when you go on vacation, that you're just happier. And so this product that we're selling, and we're selling you your own rage, basically bottled and amplified, it's emotionally destructive in the same way that cigarettes are physiologically destructive, and we don't think about it as much.
Yeah. Do you think that writing so candidly about this idea may be hazardous to your health and your career?
Actually, I found that writing about all this has been really therapeutic for me because I had all this bottled up for years because I've been struggling against it in the business. And my hope was, in writing this and showing people how the business looks from the inside and what it looks like, what the thought process of a person who creates media content is, that people would be able to protect themselves from some of this a little bit, that maybe they would not get so upset about things that are designed to get them upset.
Yeah.
So it's been, you know, for me personally, it's helped me calm down a little bit, and I hope the book also helps people not take things so seriously.
You have this great trick that you've trained yourself to use before you click on any news story online. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I imagine that I'm opening a box of cigarettes, and it's basically, if I'm going to go outside and have an MSNBC or have a Fox or something like that.
Yeah.
Because here's what people don't think about when they watch the news. They forget that it's a consumer product.
Uh-huh.
Somehow, almost everything else that we buy, we have a heightened sense of consumer awareness these days, whether it's, you know, we watch what we eat, where people are vegans, they count the calories of everything, they think about the products and what's in the furniture that their kids use, but they don't think about what the news is. The news is a consumer product. It's both something that you consume, and you yourself are also a product, because the media company is taking the information that it's getting about your news habits, and it's selling it off to a third party. So you're in the middle of a very complex consumer transaction every time you watch any news content. And people don't think about that. They think the news is just a bunch of people trying to tell you the truth about stuff, but it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, so if the news is indeed a consumer product, as you argue, does that cheapen your profession and make it more difficult for you to get motivated to devote so much time and effort to writing stories?
Yes and no. I mean, there's still, I think most of the people who do this job, most of the good reporters that I know, they didn't get into this because they wanted to get rich and make a consumer product for a large transnational corporation, which actually most of us end up working for. You know, most of us got into this profession because we wanted to be truth tellers or be writers or make good TV or whatever it is. So we're motivated by the same things that motivated people like Seymour Hersh and Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and Terry Southern and Hunter Thompson, all those people. And, you know, they didn't have commercial motivations, but we're working within a framework that is increasingly commercial. So it's difficult. I think it's in the old days when you were working in the 50s and 60s in media in America, there wasn't the expectation that news had to make money. News was very frequently a loss leader within a bigger company that made money in some other way. Now that's not true. Now if you work for the news, you have to have some kind of successful commercial formula, and that affects everybody's work.
Yeah. As you point out, reporting on homelessness during the Reagan years was a way to denounce the greed is good era. And by talking about this issue, people were showing that they cared. And you refer to how this very idea plays out in the movie based on Bret Easton Ellis' novel American Psycho. Can you tell me about this?
It's this deranged serial killer who, there's a scene where he and his friends are in an upscale restaurant in Soho, and they're talking about the news that day, and they're explaining to each other how much they care about homelessness, and about, one of them talks about how Sri Lanka and all, how all of the Sikhs are massacring all Muslims. Of course, he gets it wrong. That's part of the joke.
Oh, who gives a rat's ass?
Hey, that affects us.
Oh, well, what about the massacres in Sri Lanka, honey? Doesn't that affect us too? I mean, do you know anything about Sri Lanka? How, like, the Sikhs are killing, like, tons of Israelis over there?
Come on, Bryce. There are a lot more important problems than Sri Lanka to worry about.
Like what?
Well, we have to end apartheid, for one, and slow down the nuclear arms race, stop terrorism and world hunger. We have to provide food and shelter for the homeless and oppose racial discrimination and promote civil rights while also promoting equal rights for women. We have to encourage a return to traditional moral values. Most importantly, we have to promote general social concern and less materialism in young people.
Patrick, how thought-provoking.
But the idea is that the news in American Psycho was just another consumer product that was part of his outward expression of normalcy, whereas, you know, in fact, in the inside, he was crazy. But we do this a lot in America. We talk about the news as if knowing about it is doing something about it. And we think that by educating ourselves about how things are terrible in certain parts of the world or certain problems that are going on, that alleviates the guilt that we feel about not changing the world in the right way. Whereas in fact, in many cases, it's like something that we wear.
I was really struck by this particular statement you made in Hate Incorporated. You say, quote, "I work in this business and don't know whom to trust," end quote. So that makes me wonder, how are you able to do your job?
It's very difficult. In the last couple of years, that whole segmented demographic problem has gotten, I think, so intense that I don't know if even the most quote-unquote reputable newspapers are always accurately representing things or if they're leaving things out because they're afraid to lose their core audiences. So I actually spend a lot of time now when I want to know about a news story, I just put on my journalist hat and start calling sources to ask them rather than read the news, which is kind of a sad thing. And I think that's where we're headed in the future, is that people are going to increasingly turn to alternative sources because they're going to not trust the traditional sources as much anymore.
Yeah, besides turning to alternative sources, how else do you think the future of journalism is going to play out?
We're facing a number of pretty serious challenges right now. The situation with internet distributors has placed media companies in a dependent position that they were never in before. And in the old days, the power of, for instance, a local newspaper was the fact that it had its own distribution network. It had its own trucks. It had its own distribution points. It had its own paper kids. And they were the only people who could get, for instance, a want ad in front of the eyeballs of 2 million people in a metropolitan area. Well, distribution doesn't matter anymore because the internet reaches everybody. So, you know, the Boston Globe or the Chicago Tribune doesn't have a commercial advantage over the New York Times, even when it comes to its own audience. So the problem of how media companies maintain their own independence when they don't really have control over their own demographics and they don't have as much power as they used to, that's going to be difficult because the revenue streams that we used to count on are gone from, you know, want advertising, from local advertising, the FCC licenses for local broadcasting outlets. They make a lot less money than they used to, so I don't know who's going to be funding important journalism anymore.
Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist. He's also the author of Hate Incorporated, Why Today's Media Makes Us Despise One Another. You can find out more about Matt at WPR.org/beta.
So many people in comedy are inspired by her. People like Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Tina Fey, who are inspiring now a new generation.
Up next, Lisa Dapolito talks about her Gilda Radner documentary, Love, Gilda. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.